This morning, the United States and Russia signed a new nuclear arms control treaty. The ceremony came on the heels of President Obama's new comprehensive strategy for the use of nuclear weapons. And though both of those moves have been seen as positive steps in some parts of the arms control community, one area of the president's military policy has gone largely underreported: his administration's 2011 defense budget. It's the largest ever, and that's even after you adjust for inflation. We're joined now by Fred Kaplan, the War Stories columnist for Slate and the author of 1959, The Year Everything Changed, which will soon be released in paperback. I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show for today's underreported segment. Hello.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
The 2011 defense budget proposed by the administration is $708.2 billion. How does that number compare to military spending at the heights of the Korean and Vietnam wars?
It's higher. I mean, let's break that down, though. That includes about $200 billion for fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So you have a baseline of about $550 billion and then a couple hundred billion for war fighting. But even the $550 billion is adjusting for inflation more than all but the most expensive years of the Korean War in post-war history.
In breaking it into those two separate things, the baseline and then the overseas contingency operations, isn't he breaking with tradition?
Yeah, in fact, he's a
in
lot
the past,
more honest.
He used to lump everything together.
Well,
didn't they?
He's more honest than the Bush administration was, which, for example, in their supplemental requests for operations in Iraq, snuck in all kinds of things that really had very little to do with Iraq. So this budget is quite a lot more transparent than what we've seen recently.
There's also an additional $33 billion tacked onto this year's budget. What's that paying for?
Well, that's among the 200. That includes the 30,000 extra troops that Obama is sending to Afghanistan. That's about $33 billion. It's about $1 million per soldier once you add not just the personnel costs but all the weapons and the supplies and everything else that's needed to support a soldier in Afghanistan.
Well, how much of the increases can also be attributed to rising health care costs for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan?
That's true. About 20% of that baseline budget is for personnel. Another 5% is just for health care. And, you know, as more and more soldiers get wounded, this is going to go up and up and up. That, you know, one good thing that we can say about ourselves is that health care for veterans is generally very good. And, you know, a lot of soldiers, the kind of wounds that even 10 years ago would have killed a soldier, that the medical care is now so good that he can survive it. But this does lead to staggering health care costs over the years.
I seem to remember Joseph Stiglitz estimating that the cost of the Iraq war alone over the years will be somewhere around $3 trillion.
I remember that, and he was made fun of by Paul Wolfowitz, who thought that the whole thing would be paid for by the extra oil revenue that would come out of Iraq after Saddam's fall.
Is the president opening himself up to criticism by doing it this way? Haven't military budgets been folded into the general budget in the past?
Here's the thing, and this has been true for a long time. Nobody really looks at the military budget. If you asked even many congressmen and senators, forget about Iraq and Afghanistan. Why is it that we need to spend $550 billion for the baseline military? What's in there? Very few of them, I think, would be able to tell you.
Well, this is at a time when the president is being accused of weakening our defense.
That's just nonsense. I mean, you know, I saw this clip on Fox News the other day. It's been around the internet where the person leading into a segment says, "So, as Obama goes to Prague to sign an arms control with the Russians, does it leave us defenseless until it's too late?" And then they show a picture of an atom bomb blowing up. I mean, I have no idea what. One thing about this treaty is that it does not require. Maybe we have to cut a couple of hundred warheads. Same thing with the Russians. It requires no sacrifice of the plans that we have. If anybody can tell me one reason why this reduces our defenses, and you can pick the most outrageous definition of what our defenses is, or the most outrageous conservative criteria, if I had a hat here, I would eat it.
Why do you think, in the light of the growing deficits that we face and concerns about spending, that the president is willing to come up with such a huge budget?
Well, you know, here's the thing. If you look at the defense budget, well, here's one reason. If you look at the defense budgets going back through the early 60s, in every year, you have an almost exact one-third, one-third, one-third split among the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. Through all of the Cold War, post-Cold War, new weapon systems, I mean, it would be a miracle of precision planning if it happened that the way that the United States has divvied up its armed forces matches precisely what the needs of U.S. security are. The fact is that, you know, in the 1950s, the inter-service rivalry was so horrendous, was so intense. I mean, I've seen transcripts of conversations where the chief of naval operations is likening the U.S. Air Force to the communists. In the early 60s, when McNamara came along and started cutting into these guys' programs, they formed a pact and they said, look, let's split up the budget among ourselves. And it's been that way ever since. And every Secretary of Defense knows that if he violates this, holy hell, have to be paid. The inter-service rivalries will break out again. So a lot of it is simply the bureaucratic imperatives of keeping the chiefs satisfied.
Well, are the priorities of this administration different than the Bush administration?
Yes.
Is money being spent in other areas?
Yes. I mean, one thing that has happened is that Secretary Gates, with Obama's support, has made substantial reforms to the procurement process. I used to write a column in Slate every year listing six weapon systems that could be eliminated or slashed. Gates has eliminated or slashed five of them. That's pretty remarkable. But and also he's put more money into things like drones and smart bombs, which aren't very expensive, by the way.
But isn't there more money for things like missile defense in this budget? Didn't Mr. Obama argue against the so-called Star Wars during his presidential campaign?
Yes, this has been kind of surprising to me. The program has been reoriented, but it is about the same amount of money, about $10 billion per year. And
he said it was an unfeasible program.
That's right.
When he was in the debates with John McCain.
You know, you're absolutely right. He is putting more into theater missile defense, in other words, defending against short and medium range missiles in, say, Europe, than in the long range defense against ICBMs. And that is a bit less infeasible. But I have been a bit surprised how much Obama has embraced that program.
My guest is Fred Kaplan, the Slate columnist who writes on defense matters. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about the president's defense budget on Underreported today. Doesn't the budget also call for an increase in big-ticket weapons, like more submarines?
Some of them, yeah. I mean, he's cut out some, like stop the C-17 tankers because we have enough, the F-22 fighter plane, which was a big one. But, yeah,
F-22 fighter jet was killed by Secretary Gates.
Yes, absolutely. And that was quite a daring move. I mean, there were people in the Air Force who, if you'd given them the choice, here, you can have the F-22 or you can have everything else in your budget, but not both, they would have gone with the F-22. They were wedded to fighter planes. But no, if somebody had fallen asleep in 1986 and woken up now and said, gee, I wonder if the world has changed, let me look at the military budget, he would look at it and think, oh, the Cold War must still be going on, because the military budget predominantly is still, you know, aircraft carriers, submarines, fighter planes. It looks like we're preparing for a big war against a big foe.
Well, how much of this has just to do with political expediency? for example, all of the people in Congress who mm-hmm. want to keep programs running in their states. And I would assume that this is also a way to stimulate the economy without going to Congress and saying, hey, we have some shovel-ready programs.
You know, no, that's absolutely right. I'd say, you know, if you look at those considerations plus the inter-service bureaucratic factors, you know, 80 to 90% is explained by those things. I don't see any reason why we need to have 11 aircraft carriers and all the ships that surround them.
Well, if the new war is the war on terror,
yeah.
Unless Al-Qaeda has something that we need
no,
a submarine to counteract.
Nothing.
There's no real reason for this, is there?
If somehow the military establishment and the industrial complex just vanished overnight and you built up a military budget and structure from scratch, it would look nothing like 90% of what we have today.
Wouldn't it have been diplomatically expedient to cut out some of that missile defense? Because that was a sticking point in the negotiations with the Russians.
Well, in fact, remember about a year ago they did. There was a plan to deploy these new interceptors in the Czech Republic and a big radar in Poland, and the Russians were all upset, and Obama took that part away. Then recently he's put some of it in Romania, which, I don't know. The Russians don't find that much more.
Romania is very close to Russia.
Yes, it is. So I really am a bit puzzled by this myself. I mean, at the same time, I should say the Russian concern, I think it's not really about this couple of dozen interceptors, which really are even at the most optimistic projections of what they can accomplish is not going to, you know, wreck their nuclear deterrent or something. It's more the fact that American military personnel are being based on what used to be their empire, and they don't want us to make inroads of any kind on that territory.
So much of this is about symbolism.
Symbolism, tokens. But, you know, they're meaningful, though. Let's say the Russians have some plan in the long run to not take over militarily, but to dominate all of Eastern Europe once again. Having a few thousand American soldiers on, say, Czech soil is a pretty firm token of our commitment to their security.
Against the Russians.
Yeah.
Well, it says to the Russians, we think you're going to, you might invade, and the Russians are saying, don't insult us, aren't they?
Yes, right. I know, exactly. So it's look, the fact is, relations between the United States and Russia are much better than they were even 2 years ago, but there is this tremendous legacy of distrust and some interests that are not shared.
Well, all the Russians do these days is cut off your gas supply.
That's right.
They don't have to invade.
Absolutely.
The Office of Management and Budget has predicted that the Pentagon's budget will decline in 2012. What are they basing that projection on?
Well, this, I'm afraid to say, is typical budget games. When you're looking at, well, what is the deficit overall going to be over the next 10 years, and you have an interest in showing that the deficit goes down and down and down, you maneuver some numbers. Some assumptions of this are that operations and maintenance budget is going to go down by $100 billion in the next couple of years, when in fact it's likely to go up as our operations in Afghanistan increase. Personnel costs are going to go down, yet I don't see anybody talking about cutting military salaries or reducing the size of the Army. So there is quite a bit of statistical gamesmanship to get to this notion that the deficit is going down. I think that members of the Armed Services Committee should take a very close look at what big-ticket weapons items might be cut further to ensure that these other things are continued to be funded.
Well, more of the money would then go to bases in countries that are unstable.
For example, Afghanistan, if we are going to be there for a while, it's been estimated that because, you know, Saddam Hussein in Iraq had air bases all over the country. When we came in there, the infrastructure was set. Afghanistan has nothing. It basically costs $3 or $4 to support each soldier in Afghanistan, three or four times more to support a soldier in Afghanistan than it costs to support him or her in Iraq. So those costs are just going to go up and up.
The Conservative Heritage Foundation attacked the president's military budget on its blog. They say that the proposed budget is too small and that the projected cuts in 2012 are draconian.
This is just, I mean, you know, again, I don't know what they're talking about. And I think if you ask them, well, what is being cut that you think ought to be increased? What is there that needs to be increased more and for what purpose? I think they'd have a very hard time justifying that claim.
You mentioned in a Slate article you wrote in February that the White House has supposedly promised the Pentagon an additional $100 billion increase in the baseline budget over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Do we have any idea what kinds of projects that money will be funneled into?
It's basically just the projections of what these things pan out at over the next 5 years. I think it's if nothing else is cut from the baseline budget in terms of force structure or weapons, that's going to have to be a lot more. And in fact, if you look at the projections for how much more is going to be spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, say next year, they have what they call a placeholder supplemental of $50 billion. But this is just a deposit. I mean, it's unless we're just pulling out of Afghanistan next month, that's going to at least double or triple.
How much of this money is going to pay for private security contractors in Iraq and now more and more in Afghanistan?
You know, it's a very good question. I don't think I haven't seen anything that parses it out. Although I would say that tends to be a bit exaggerated. It's not. We're not talking about tens of billions of dollars here.
Barack Obama said he was going to cut back on
well,
that.
Well, here's the thing.
But because the Bush administration was privatizing, but we have not cut back.
Well, here's most of these contractors. I mean, in the old days when there was a draft and some person who wasn't very smart is drafted, he was put on KP. He was put on, mowing the lawn or something. No soldier does that today. Those are all contractors. Most contractors are doing the kind of grunt work that now today's Army doesn't have enough people to do. And, actually, the median intelligence measured by a lot of indicators that you might find invalid anyway shows that the average soldier, sailor, airman is smarter than the average counterpart in the civilian world of, a cohort of that age. It's a very mechanized, it's very computerized military. You've got pretty smart people running these things. The kind of base operations, maintenance, that's where most of these contractors are. And since we don't have a draft, you have to pay these guys more than what ordinary soldiers make. And that is where a lot of the costs are going.
We talked about criticism from the right, but some critics of the president on the left are looking at this budget and saying, didn't Barack Obama win the Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, it's funny. I mean, what they're really looking at is that they're disappointed that in his new nuclear doctrine, he didn't declare an absolute no first use policy. But, I think in a lot of realms, whether it's military policy, healthcare, or whatever, a lot of people on the left projected a lot onto Barack Obama. Obama said all during the campaign, we're pulling out of Iraq and we're committing more to Afghanistan. I think a lot of people thought, oh, well, he's just saying that so he can pull out of Iraq. Once he's in power, he'll pull out of Afghanistan too. Well, no, it turns out that wasn't the case. He really meant what he said. I think look, on no first use, he came very close to that in his doctrine. He's saying he won't use nuclear weapons first against a country that is obeying the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that counts just about everybody except North Korea and Iran. If you thought that he was going to say, we're not going to use nuclear weapons first against anybody, and I'm cutting down right away to 1,000 warheads instead of 1,500... and I'm letting the nuclear arsenal kind of rot away until we're down to zero. Well, you have a very superficial understanding of what American politics are all about. And if you thought that he would get an arms treaty through Congress or wouldn't have rebellion among the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you're a little dim.
My guest is Fred Kaplan, the War Stories columnist for Slate. We're talking about the military budget on today's Underreported. Last month, China announced that it was increasing its military budget by only 7.5%. Now, the Chinese have been increasing theirs by double figures until just this year.
It's hard, you know, their own figures, especially since it's kind of a command economy, they don't really mean very much. It is true that China is doing a few things. They're building a lot more military forces in the area around the Taiwan Straits. I mean, a lot. They're also developing some naval capacity that can extend to the South China Sea islands. These are things worth concerned about, but you know, I've been hearing since I was an undergraduate that China's about to build a blue water navy that can project power across the world. That just isn't happening.
Well, what we've been hearing on NPR is a series on the next war actually being a cyber war more than anything else.
Well, this is my old graduate school classmate Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, has a book coming out called Cyber War, which is I'm going to be writing about that. It's a very frightening and very important book. And yeah, the reason I think why it hasn't been discussed more is that every aspect of it is so embedded in secrecy and is so impossible for people like you and me to understand that it's hard to get your hands around. But yeah, I think this is definitely going to have to be an arena not just for military competition, but also, I hope, a new definition of arms control and diplomacy.
Well, Clark has been pointing out that in the past we had mad mutually assured mm-hmm. destruction. If you bomb us, we're going to bomb you into oblivion. But in the case of a cyber war, we would pretty much be totally vulnerable after we were attacked.
Yeah, apparently we have substantial offensive capabilities in this regard, too. The things that we criticize China for doing, we do that, too. But we are much more vulnerable to this sort of thing than any other country because so much of what we do relies on computerized networks, which can be entered into from the Internet, whereas China and most other countries can isolate a lot of their infrastructure, electrical power grid, that sort of thing, so that if we did retaliate, you know, so what? It's not going to hurt them so much.
In this whole business about signing an agreement with the Russians, to reduce our nuclear arms capability, aren't we really just recognizing reality? We no longer are in a mad situation. Mm-hmm. There's no country that's likely to try to drop an atomic bomb on us. If there isn't a nuclear attack of any sort, it's more likely to be a dirty bomb that is in some kind of a suitcase.
Yeah, well, look, here's the thing. You know, if you go back to the arms control talks back during the Cold War, even they were not substantially about reducing nuclear weapons. What they were about, they were a way for U.S. and Russian diplomats to get together and talk at a time when they really couldn't talk about anything else. There was nothing else to talk about. So they got to know each other. They scoped out each other's intentions, established means of mutual trust. I hope that's all that's going on with this. If we get wrapped up in these intensely detailed negotiations about do we count this kind of missile but not that kind of bomber, how do we do this, which only lead to more tensions. I see arms control now and before as a prerequisite to talking about things that on which we have common interest and on which progress can be made.
Although there still are North Korea and Iran to be concerned about. How
Absolutely.
Seriously should we take them as threats?
Threats to us? Not so much.
I mean,
threats
do we
to
need to have
region?
8 million missiles aimed at them?
Oh, we don't have that many missiles aimed at them. But I don't know how. It wouldn't take much. It wouldn't take much. But, you know, why does a country have nuclear weapons? I mean, if Iran got a nuclear weapon tomorrow, it's not necessarily the case that they'd attack Tel Aviv next week, although Israel is right to be concerned about that. What it does, though, is that they've long had regional ambitions to be the major power in the region. Our destruction of Saddam Hussein's Iraq and the Taliban's Afghanistan frees them up to do this even more. And when you have a nuke, when you have a pocket full of nukes, you can use it as coercion. You can use it as intimidation. I think that if Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons before he invaded Kuwait, I seriously doubt that George H.W. Bush would have been able to amass the kind of coalition that he did to beat them back with political legitimacy. When James Baker said to Saddam during that war, at which time Saddam had chemical weapons on the top of Scud missiles. If you fire those chemical Scuds at Israel, we'll regard that as a nuclear attack against the United States. I don't know if he could have credibly said that if Saddam Hussein had had his own nuclear weapons. So it gives you prestige, it gives you leverage in any chicken game of intimidation elsewhere, and it creates a sense of false confidence that can get an entire region into serious trouble.
We've been talking about the president's new defense budget on today's Underreported with Fred Kaplan, the War Stories columnist for Slate. His latest book, 1959, The Year Everything Changed, will soon be released in paperback. And thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.